This is Central Time. When we think of historic Wisconsin fires, the Great Peshtigo Fire of 1871 is one of the first to come to mind. But the author of a new book tells the story of another great 1800s fire, one among the deadliest unsolved possible arsons in American history. Matthew Prigge is an author and historian from Milwaukee. He created the What Made Milwaukee Famous radio series for WMSE Radio in Milwaukee, and his latest book is called Damn the Old Tinderbox, Milwaukee's Palace of the West and the Fire That Defined an Era. Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, let's set the scene as you do in the book. Tell us about this desire in Milwaukee to have a fancy luxury hotel to make us make Milwaukee a stronger rival to cities like Chicago.
Well, this was back in the 1850s, and there was this belief among a lot of civic boosters and businessmen, and particularly the Milwaukee Sentinel newspaper, that having a luxury hotel here was really what Milwaukee needed to keep up with Chicago. As you might know, that Milwaukee and Chicago were pretty near equal in terms of, or fairly equal in terms of population up until the time that the railroads came to the American Midwest, and that kind of set Chicago apart as the more obvious hub for goods coming in from the west, shipping into the east. So Milwaukee kind of latched onto this idea of having a world-class hotel here as a way to try to regain footing in that that competition with Chicago.
And along comes this grocer, a successful builder of a grain elevator, who finds himself in the hotel business. What happened?
The Daniel Newhall came to Milwaukee in the 1840s, right around the time things were starting to take off, and he had a grocery business. He traded in grain. He made himself a fortune, and he wanted to get into the hotel business. He was the one that kind of took the initiative to build this palace, and he had the money to do so, and he also had kind of a tendency to take big risks, to invest big, and he was the one who went all in on this idea of a world-class hotel in the city.
Now, a little foreshadowing here. You keep quoting newspaper articles that said, well, since this block burned down, this would be a great place to have a hotel. Fires, it seemed like were a fact of life through the 1800s in Milwaukee.
Yeah, they were very common, and in a lot of ways, it's surprising that there weren't more disastrous fires like this. You said, the area of, a hotel and a barn would burn down, and they'd be like, the Sentinel would be out 2 days later saying what a great spot this would be for a new luxury hotel.
Now tell us about this Newhall House Hotel that ended up finally being built.
Well, it was pretty audacious for its time in both the size and the luxury. As you mentioned in the intro, it might have been at the time it was completed in 1857, the tallest building in the country, and possibly the tallest inhabitable building in the country and maybe in the world. There really wasn't much of a competition for that then. I don't think in 1850 having the tallest hotel in the world would have been considered much of a thing, because this building, by modern standards, wasn't very tall. It was only six stories. But, they really went big with it. It had a very ornate cupola at the very top, from which you could see the entire city. Every luxury you could imagine in 1857, the Newhall House had it.
Talking to historian Matthew Prigge about his new book, Damn the Old Tinderbox, Milwaukee's Palace of the West and the Fire That Defined an Era. Well, talk a little bit before we get to the big fire, Matthew, about the history of this hotel between building and destruction. A lot of ups and a lot more downs along the way, it seems like.
Yeah, it was, if the idea was bold to put a hotel of this scope in Milwaukee, there was probably a reason for that. There really wasn't a great market for these high-end hotel rooms. Almost as soon as they built it, or as soon as it was opened, there were rumors that it was in financial trouble. The first two men who took out the lease on it, they were only able to pay a fraction of what they had agreed on as the lease price back to Daniel Newhall. Newhall owned it for about a decade until he sold it. He ended up selling it for about half of what it cost him to build it. It transferred through a number of hands over the next couple decades. Just nobody really able to make a go at it, both proprietors, the people who ran it, and Eventually, it was sold into a kind of a stock company of local businessmen who really just wanted to make sure that it stayed open and not to have this giant luxurious building just sitting there. So very hard to make money with the Newhall House, either owning it or operating it.
And briefly, before we get to the big fire, there were a couple of significant fires in this hotel along the way, right?
Yeah, there were a few. One where they actually removed some rooms from the hotel that had been burned through. And allegedly, a couple of fires that were purposely set by persons to this day unknown.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Matthew Prigge. He is a historian from Milwaukee, author of several historical books. His latest, we're talking about it now, is Damn the Old Tinderbox, Milwaukee's Palace of the West and the Fire That Defined an Era. Matthew, take us to the night of the fire. What were the first signs that the Newhall House Hotel was on fire?
Well, this was January 1883, and it was about 3 a.m. Pretty much everybody in the house, except for the three staff members who were on duty that night, were asleep. And there was a porter who was coming down in the elevator. He dropped somebody off on an upper floor, and he was going back down to the lobby floor, which was on the second floor, and smoke started to fill the elevator. So he hopped off. He got the guy at the front desk, and they went down to the basement, and they found that it was full of smoke, and there was a fire of, they weren't exactly sure where it was at the time. They're pretty sure it was at the base of the elevator shaft. And by that time, the fire was already pretty well underway. It's catching in the elevator shaft like that. It was able to spread very quickly because in elevators of those times, they actually had open caps on the roof above the elevator shaft, and especially it being such a cold night, just the warm air of the hotel was being drawn up through this elevator shaft. So as soon as it got going in the basement near the base of the elevator shaft, the flames pretty much shot right up to the roof within, I imagine, a few minutes of it really getting going.
Now, ultimately, over 70 people are going to die. The hotel's going to be destroyed. But those first people to see the fire, you write, make a pivotal decision. They try to fight it themselves. They don't call the fire company.
Correct. Well, they did call upon the first sight of fire, they ran into the basement. They tried to assess the situation themselves. They, as many of the fires that had occurred at the hotel before, were handled in-house, either with the fire hoses or they had buckets of water pretty much kept everywhere in case of fire. So they made that assumption that this was something they'd be able to handle themselves. And by the time, you know, we're talking just a few minutes here, but by the time they realized that this was beyond their control, you could say that the house, the fate of the house was pretty much sealed.
Talk about the efforts of, once the fire companies were alerted, their efforts to try to save as many people as they could.
Well, the firefighting profession back then was still pretty Spartan. There's not a lot of training done comparative to today. These were a lot of the people who were in charge of fire companies were political appointees. So it was kind of a mixed bag and a rugged group of people who whose daring, I write, might have overshadowed any formal training they had. But by the time they got there, they had pretty much given up. Again, this is maybe 10 minutes after the fire is discovered. They pretty much given up on trying to fight it from inside by any decent means. So they were pretty much fighting the fire from the streets through the windows and trying to get ladders up to the people who by this time had woken up, and a lot of them were pushed back by the fire and trapped in their rooms.
A lot of your book tells the story of those who perished and survived the fire. I'll leave that to readers. We could take hours to talk about all those separate stories. Tell us where the title of your book came from, Damn the Old Tinderbox.
There's a lot of newspaper accounts of the things that happened in the streets as this fire was going on, and the quote or the statement is taken from a quote that I think it was the Milwaukee Sentinel. Apparently, they observed a man running away from the building, screaming, "Damn the old tinderbox! Damn Milwaukee!"
And did this, after the fire, did this change things in terms of how the city dealt with fire, how firefighters dealt with fire in reaction to this hugely catastrophic fire?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was one of the interesting things that I found out in doing this, because the narrative of this that does exist in Milwaukee histories, you know, sometimes they'll follow up the story of the fire by saying that, well, Milwaukee as a city made some changes in the names in the name of fire safety, but not much happened in the aftermath of this fire in terms of requiring more from the people who own these buildings, more clearly marked fire exits, things like that. In fact, just a few months after the Newhall House fire, later in 1883, there was a fire that started kind of similarly in the basement at the Plankinton House, which was by that time the city's leading luxury hotel. And this fire had the fortune of starting right around the dinner hour, so everybody was awake. It was spotted very quickly. They called the fire department and put it out. There was some damage, but no loss of life or anything. And afterwards, the fire chief basically admitted, you know, if this had happened in the middle of the night, it probably would have been another Newhall House.
Matthew, I don't want to let you go without talking about some of the mystery here. The big question, sure. Was this fire intentional? Was this arson? What do we know?
Well, it's not to spoil anything, but I do approach a couple of different what I view as the most likely scenarios as to how the fire would have started. There was a lot of talk about these previous fires that had been set at the Newhall, and that obviously raises a lot of red flags. But there, in the aftermath of the big fire, there was really no, you know, people talked about it in sort of hushed tones. They're like, well, we knew who was doing that, and they've left the city, and they're, you know, that wasn't a problem anymore. So if anybody was, you know, in the know on who this person might have been, there was really no interest in that person after this fire. There was also a bartender, the proprietor of the bar at the Newhall House, who was actually charged and put on trial for setting the fire. And I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say that by the end of that trial, the city was basically celebrating his acquittal, because it became so clear that he had nothing to do with this. And the other scenario, the one that, well, I'll leave that one for the reader to find out on their own. There's a little mystery there. It was not necessarily of malicious intent, but might have been an accidental setting of the fire.
Matthew, thanks a lot for sharing the story with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Matthew J. Priggy is an author and historian from Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about his new book, Damn the Old Tinderbox, Milwaukee's Palace of the West and the Fire that Defined an Era. You can hear Matthew talk about his new book at the official launch on Tuesday, March 19th at 7 p.m. at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. Coming up after the news, we'll learn about a new suicide prevention task force starting in the state assembly and what efforts are already underway here in Wisconsin. First is the Wisconsin Public Radio Spring Membership Drive. Jay Carlisle Larson is in the studio with me to ask for your support of the conversations you count on. You can do that online at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
We have a little bit more than about 30 minutes left in this hour, and we're still looking for 8 people to join the team, but I want to say thank you if you've already given.
If you haven't, give now at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. Your gift funds all the programs you count on.
Now, in the last segment, we heard about the fascinating mystery surrounding the 1883 fire at Milwaukee's Newhall House Hotel, which at the time was one of the tallest buildings in the nation. That's something I certainly hadn't heard before, and it's the kind of intriguing Wisconsin stories that you can rely on when you listen to Central Time.
Yeah, I keep learning more and more new stuff about Wisconsin on this show. Just in the last week, honestly, there's been so much. Well, if you appreciate that kind of conversation, that all these curious things going on, past, present, and future in the state, pledge in support of that. Make your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. 2552.
And we have a really cool method to join the team. You can become a sustainer. And when you become a sustainer, you choose a monthly gift amount and set it up to come from your bank account or credit card, and it'll continue for as long as you'd like.
Because WPR is one of those things you never want to be without. Provide some reliable support with a convenient, flexible, sustaining membership. Get started now with your gift of $10 or $20 a month at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Families often tell us how WPR brings them closer together. Children and parents listen together before school and on the weekends, using WPR as kind of a jumping off point for a lot of conversations. And spouses get together too at the end of the day to talk about the stories that they've heard.
Listening to WPR can be a point of connection between you and your loved ones and your friends. Your support right now keeps that connection going at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You love WPR because it's your source for intelligent radio, and there are costs associated with this high-quality radio, and that is where you come in. Your support is really crucial.
That's right. You support great radio and a couple extra reasons to pledge. If you pledge $10 a month or more, you can ask for the new WPR t-shirt, and when you pledge any amount, you're automatically entered into a drawing for a gift card, a $500 gift card at a grocery store. There are five of those available. So good reason to pledge now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We are still looking for eight people to join the team and support the WPR programs that they rely on every single day. We have about 30 minutes left in the hour to help meet our goal. WPR is listener powered, and that is why your gift right now at WPR.org or by calling 888-202-2552 is really, really important.
We can't do it without you. We need your support to keep this great service coming to you each and every day. Make your gift right now at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. And thank you so much for your contribution. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss announced the creation of a statewide suicide prevention task force. The goal of the group is to assess the state's current prevention efforts and find the best ways to help at-risk groups, including farmers and younger people. According to the State Department of Health Services, more than 700 state residents die by suicide each year in the state. Before we continue, if you or a loved one are concerned about suicidal thoughts, there is help available. You can call the hotline at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. You can also contact the crisis text line by texting 741-741. Again, that's 741-741. Our next guest is here to talk about prevention efforts already underway in the state and what could still be improved. Leah Rolando is a suicide prevention specialist at Mental Health America of Wisconsin. Leah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first of all, what's your reaction to the announcement of this new task force in the state?
I'm really excited, and my phone has been blowing up all morning and yesterday, too. A lot of folks are hearing about this information, and so we know there's excitement in the at the Capitol, across the state, for suicide prevention efforts to be expanded, so we're really excited. And it was really perfect timing today. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, Wisconsin chapter, had an advocacy day at the Capitol, so we have been meeting all day with legislators and talking about what's going on.
Before we look at what this task force will tackle and what room for improvement we have, what's out there now? What kind of efforts do we already have in place that you think are important to look at?
Yeah, we're doing a lot in Wisconsin, really. And we know that any approach to suicide prevention needs to be a comprehensive approach. So we have a steering committee for Prevent Suicide Wisconsin. And we're focused on a lot of different areas like healthcare, schools, intentionally focusing on populations at disproportionate risk for suicide. And so some of that work includes our zero suicide work that's within healthcare systems, having healthcare system teams go through a training, learn about suicide prevention, how to improve their efforts, and then engage in a virtual learning community.
Let's talk about that idea, the zero suicide idea. Yeah. I believe there was a healthcare facility in the Detroit area that pioneered this. Talk about that as a goal.
Yeah. So zero suicide is a broad philosophy, and it's a bold, broad philosophy about we really can prevent we really can get to zero suicide. So that's really the philosophy of we're going to do everything in our power to make sure people have a safety net when they're in services, when they leave services, whether that's in hospitals or outpatient, inpatient. That varies across the state. But we know what works, and we're always using evidence-based strategies to get that out throughout the state.
And you mentioned at-risk groups. In this task force, they point out they include younger people and farmers in that. Can you talk about those two groups?
Yeah, we know that the suicide rate is on the rise for farmers, especially, you know, in rural Wisconsin. And so we have some great advocates in rural Wisconsin working on this, and farmers sharing their experiences, their lived experience with either suicidal thoughts or suicide attempts. So we know what has worked there is farmers sharing their experiences of recovery and achieving wellness. And that's just one piece, making sure the message is about suicide prevention and that we can do things to make this better. And then also expanding peer run services. So there's a group called Tugs, and that's ran by a farmer in Wisconsin. And he works just connecting farmers to one another and talking about just issues and day-to-day lives.
We talked to him on the show. Yeah,
awesome.
This sounded like a great effort. Let's talk about access to care, mental health care in particular, that people might need. How are we doing in Wisconsin?
We're getting there. We know today at Advocacy Day for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, we talked about mental health parity and making sure pre-existing conditions don't exclude people from receiving the benefits that they need. So we're always working on expanding county-based services, clinical services, everything we can do to meet the needs of the communities we live in.
Talking to Leah Rolando, suicide prevention specialist at Mental Health America of Wisconsin, looking at a new assembly task force aimed at reducing the suicide rate here in Wisconsin, ultimately hoping to bring it down to zero, at least some efforts in the state. That is their goal. Leah, one of the things the task force is tasked with is trying to figure out ways to use technology for suicide prevention. What kind of things might be out there?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what they mean by that, but a lot of things come to mind. We really want to improve our data collection efforts and our data on evaluating programs in Wisconsin. So MHA, Mental Health America of Wisconsin, partners with the Department of Health Services to make sure we have access to this data. And so when we have data sources that can tell us what suicide looks like in Wisconsin, we're better able to inform our prevention efforts. And so we're right in the middle of updating the 2019 suicide prevention report. And so we'll be talking with lots of stakeholders about how is this data going to inform your prevention efforts, and what are the good ways to look at this data and help you.
What else are you seeing in the charge for this task force that you think is worth paying attention to?
Yeah, they focus on youth too, and so we know there are programs in Wisconsin. A few examples are Hope Squad, Sources of Strength, Signs of Suicide. Really, we have a lot of options for what we can do in terms of funding school-based services, and the Department of Public Instruction is critical in that, so they have a lot of suicide prevention resources for schools already. So we just want to build capacity to let schools and educators know what's out there, to make sure youth are equipped to handle crises and talk to their friends, and their friends know who to talk to if somebody's in crisis, and ultimately get the help they need.
And I understand that lesbian, gay, transgender people, especially younger people maybe, I don't know, are at a higher risk of suicide, or at least suicidal thoughts, suicidal ideation, I think it's called. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, or what were you going to say? I think it's called
suicidal ideation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we know that LGBTQ youth, and specifically transgender youth in particular, are at increased risk for suicidal thoughts, attempts. And we know data shows that if a school has, for example, a gay-straight alliance, that reduces the risk for suicide for all students in that school. And so when we have affirming, inclusive environments for kids, especially LGBTQ kids, we know that their risk for suicide is dramatically decreased.
A common theme when I look at the at-risk groups, it might be the farmer who doesn't feel like they can admit, they feel weak if they bring up this problem. If you're a LGBTQ youth, you might feel like you're the only one in your situation. Yeah. I think people who have just been through divorce, slightly higher risk. Isolation, people who don't feel that connection. How big a common theme is that?
That is the biggest theme, and you set me up perfectly to talk about the theme of our conference, and that's coming up on May 3rd. Connection is the theme, and people are realizing that if you can connect people to one another, connect people to resources, that's really at the heart of prevention.
Now, you've mentioned various institutions. We've got the state government involved at this. You mentioned education, healthcare providers. Since this is kind of an all-hands-on-deck approach, how about people listening, everyday people? What kind of things can they look out for, ways that they can help break through that isolation for people in their lives?
Yeah, that's a huge piece. We have one of the cool things about Prevent Suicide Wisconsin is that we have county coalitions throughout the entire state. And so these are led by volunteers, and a lot of what the coalitions do are just raising awareness, doing gatekeeper trainings. So that's asking somebody if they're thinking about suicide, and then they say yes. So then you persuade them to stay alive, and then you refer them to services. So just making sure you know how to have that conversation and having the courage to ask that question, are you thinking about suicide? That can be the biggest question.
I think, and I've brought this up with some of the other people we've talked to, especially about rural suicide, is we're polite Midwesterners. We don't want to come off as nosy or meddling or things like that. How can we encourage people and train people, I guess, to get past that way of thinking, to reach out to people?
Yeah. I mean, really, thoughts of suicide are more common than people think. And so when we have these conversations on a public platform like this, we want to talk about lived experience and the fact that we can talk about somebody having suicidal thoughts, but living through that and not using suicide as an option. So I just think it's really important to keep talking about prevention and lived experience and recovery.
And how important is it just to be having the conversation about this? I think a lot of times this is viewed by a family maybe as a dark secret that we don't talk about. And again, in rural Wisconsin, we're hearing more people coming out and talking about their own lives, the lives of their loved ones.
Yeah, it's a big conversation, and we never want to make families who have lost loved ones to suicide feel guilty about missing the signs. A lot of times there are signs, but really we do miss them sometimes. So I think it's important to continue talking about this and supporting those who have lost loved ones to suicide, making sure there's services for them as well.
So this task force was just announced. As we wrap up, what are your hopes for this effort from the state on top of what you and other groups in the state are already doing?
Yeah, my biggest hope is that everybody is just ready to align efforts. I hope that there is increased funding for all the services that we're talking about. Suicide prevention is and should be a bipartisan issue, and so folks on the task force should be looking into evidence-based strategies that we know actually reduce the suicide rate. So I'm just hoping the state can get on the same page with all of this, and we can actually make an impact and move the needle on suicide in Wisconsin.
We'll leave it there. Leah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Leah Rolando is a suicide prevention specialist at Mental Health America of Wisconsin. She joins us today to talk about Assembly Speaker Robin Voss's newly announced Suicide Prevention Task Force and what efforts are already underway around the state to reduce suicide in Wisconsin. And again, if you or your family member are having suicidal thoughts or you're concerned about these issues, you can call 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. You can also contact the crisis text line with a text at 741-741. Again, 741-741.